The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 421 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Thank you for your understanding. We took a week off for the holidays with my family. I was able to travel overseas, and what was the first time since 2019, and see friends, family, loved ones, and so on. Of course, it was very special. It felt like a pre-pandemic time, of course, though. But yes, face masks on aeroplanes and public transport and so on. But of course, that's the way it should be. That's the way it is. But this episode 421, we gave priority to Patreon supporters. Those are the people who support us on patreon.com/Columbia Calling. Those who support us financially here at the podcast. And they sent in questions, Columbia-related questions, Emily Hart and I, are going to endeavor to answer as best we can. Of course, this is a follow-on from 407, the first one of the year, the first episode of the year in which we did the same, and it was immensely popular and very, very successful indeed, and people asked for us to do it once again, so this is the second Q&A episode of the year, and we have questions that came in from Nicholas, Julian, Susan, Sarah Louise, Simon, Emma Louise, Donald, Tigran, and if I've missed you out, I apologize. But thank you so much to all of those of you who sent in questions, and we'll try to cover them all in this episode. Q&A episode 421. Thank you again for listening. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling, episode 421. Thank you for allowing us a week off during the holidays. I'm here with Emily. Emily's on the line.
Hi, everyone.
If you're watching on YouTube, there is sun in Bogota. As I'm even squinting after all the rain of the last few days.
Miserable cold and rain in Medellin. So we've had some kind of grossly unjust exchange.
Oh no, but honestly, the last 4 days, I've not seen as much water falling as in this last 4 days. Maybe it's because I had an awesome holiday in the sun, but it's been so miserable here and dark. So maybe this is our hour. This is our hour. I don't know, but it's raining all through the country. So maybe that's it. I don't know. Emily, how's everything going at the same time? You're working very hard. We've got questions and answers this week. Are
you ready? We've got questions and answers. I am ready and will do my very best. There's a couple at the end that I've slightly struggled to even get my head around, but we'll see. Let's go for it.
Well, we're going to do it this way. We'll do the expat immigrant related questions to begin with. Politics and peace. Travel, tourism, and then the miscellaneous ones at the end, which are the ones you get your head around. But they're kind of just more jokey ones, of course, as well. So we'll start sort of mid-range, then go up into the more, what would you say, intense, and then start coming back down again. You know, the way we would do the podcast as well. And you are perfectly positioned for this first question. Bogota versus Medellin, pros and cons in terms of living with a family.
I mean, in terms of living with a family, I am one of those single, childless women in their 30s you read about in op-eds. So I'm afraid I can't help on that. But I'll hand over to you on the on the family one. But my only real driving force in where I live, I worry a lot of the time, is sunlight.
Yep.
So for me, Medellin is the winner simply because I am a simple sort of an organism in that I need light and water. And my time in Bogota has been spent usually without the former and with too much of the latter. So
I think that's it. I think it ends up coming down to, that's the basic, isn't it? Is the weather, the Bogota weather is not good. When it is nice and crisp and clear and mountainous, it's awesome. It really is. But like right now, it's not. And so, and Medellin obviously is much warmer. Yeah, I guess you get to see all your frat boys in their flip-flops and shorts all the time.
Nothing like seeing the feet of a frat boy wandering Poblado to really make your day. But I feel like the question's sort of driving at infrastructure for life as well. And as I said, my life's very, very simple. I don't have to worry about, schools, how are they in Bogota?
Excellent. And I think that's where Bogota probably, and don't crucify me, people in Medellin. I think that's where Bogota wins out. I think, okay. Medellin has a metro and we're only just knocking down buildings here. But in terms of schools for a family, yeah, I mean, if you're looking at private schools, they abound. On an international level with international baccalaureate and so on, there are schools to choose from. You are not, restricted. I know that the Medellin has a French lycée, so that's a good thing. And I know that there's some other private schools, but there does seem to be a lot of schools here because I got given a spreadsheet made by another mother while she was pregnant and all the schools that she was considering applying to. We only ended up applying to two, and got accepted into the two, but she did 30 odd. So there you go. I mean, it's something to go through. I think, and if you say infrastructure, yeah, of course, Medellin has great infrastructure in terms of public transport. And its surroundings are so wonderful as well, getting out at the weekend. There's so much, there's just too much. It just kind of depends, really. I think at the end, it just comes down to the weather. I think we could just boil it all down to that.
But I think there's something sort of, without wanting to generalize too much, in terms of sort of the basic pleasures, like going to the countryside at a weekend, getting some sun, throwing yourself in a charco. Medellin has it, but in terms of, a rich cultural life, proximity to the structures of power, schools, kind of that kind of stuff, Bogota obviously wins out. I sometimes wonder if it's a slightly more adult city. Like you say, Medellin attracts, my demographic and the frat boys, sure. But at a certain age, will I find myself wanting to move to Bogota?
When I was young and footloose and fancy free, there was nothing better than Medellin. But then after a while, I was like, I need to be more a participant as a journalist. And I found that Bogota lent more to me in terms of, as you said, the structure of power. And that just became a bit easier. And I don't know, it was that kind of thing. And in the end, it took a long time for me to adapt to Bogota. And now I worked out is that you live where you want to spend your time rather than trying to get around the city, which is obviously incredibly painful. I walk to my son's nursery school, and then my other son's school bus picks him up at our doorstep. So our doorstep is actually the bus stop for the school. There are 12 other children have to come down from other places, but we just fall out of bed. But I think that's what you work out. And I just live in an area where people have no issue coming to meet you in this area, sort of thing. It's good coffee shops, good restaurants, and so on. So I think it's, whereas in London, for example, and I don't know, we should obviously compare, you don't really mind dragging yourself across the city or something because, in my experience,
normalized. Yeah, someone lives an hour away, you're like, that's reasonable. Okay, an hour and a half, they're like, oh, I'll see you a bit less often. Yeah. But an hour on the tube with a couple of changes. Yeah. Totally normalized.
Whereas here, I could see the airport from where I'm sitting. I think, God, I've got to get down there. Someone says, oh, I'm coming through for an hour. You want to go? No, I'm just not going down there. I'm not doing it. So I think there's that as well. Medellin obviously is smaller, and I guess you're more restrained to the bowl of the valley as well. So, But, you know, in terms of, I guess, culture and cosmopolitan life, they both have their assets. But, I mean, as the capital, Bogota would take it.
But I think
again,
so, yeah.
Again, there's a lot of people in Medellin listening, I know. And I'm just trying to tread carefully around this. And, you know, it's a sensitive subject.
It's the capital city. And as much as Paisas believe with all of their Paisa hearts that Medellin should be the capital city, it just isn't. And that comes with a bunch of consequences. I mean, I like Medellin. Mm-hmm. I live here.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say I'm necessarily a lifer. There are things that appeal about Bogota. If I buy myself a good enough set of thermals, who knows? You know,
it has been cold. Would you? I mean, when you talk about that's an interesting topic, and we can't go into it too much because when you say the Paisa love, and they say that this should be the capital. We have a metro. If we gave all of the issues that came with being a capital city to Medellin, like all of the negative issues and all of the, do you think it would be able to cope within that, in that valley geographically, geographically?
No, I mean, this is one of the great underestimated features of Colombia in terms of governability. Yeah. Is that it's got a really difficult landscape. And, you know, they say there was a recent study and some enormous percentage of Colombia is at risk of landslides under heavy rain. Hmm. And a lot of those areas have homes and infrastructure in. It's not an easy country to do infrastructure. So I think if you made it the capital city, you'd be looking at population growth, which I'm not sure is safe and less well managed, and whether or not there's the resources or skills for that. You know, it would be super complicated. Quite aside from the type of politics that exists in Antioquia, which we don't need to go into in great detail, but I don't know that it's particularly safe to put more political power structures in an area like Antioquia, all things considered, historical and present.
That was very carefully put. I enjoyed that answer. Thank you.
And yet, everyone will know what I meant.
Absolutely everyone knows what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So here we go. Let's jump into the next one then. And it says, what challenges do expats in Colombia experience? And is there a stigma attached to being a foreigner in Colombia? What changes have you had to make your everyday behavior given the relative perception of insecurity that prevails in Bogota and across the country? That's two questions, isn't it? But the first one, what challenges do expats, I suppose, immigrants to Colombia experience? Is there a stigma? I don't know if there's a stigma. I mean, we're always treated with quite a lot of deference. I would say.
Yeah, I think that might be a
stigma.
A male experience. Deference has certainly not been my general experience of, you know, differential treatment. But stigma feels very loaded as a word. I would say that, you know, my Venezuelan friends would tell me that they experience stigma from being immigrants to this country. As a Brit, you know, sometimes I don't like the characterizations that are assumed of me because I'm a foreign woman. But I have to say the people that I blame for that are other foreigners in Colombia. You know, if somebody sees me at the airport and assumes that I'm a white American who speaks no Spanish and is about to go to a hostel in Poblado, that's an assumption based on a long and broad experience of white people arriving at the airport who are white gringos going to Poblado. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't...
Yeah.
And, you know, if they expect you to be badly behaved or ignorant, that's again, probably the fault of some other tourists who've behaved badly or in an ignorant way. So I'm not quite sure it's stigma. I think it's something that developed countries, uncomfortable expression, but, you know, global north countries who go and do tourism in global south countries, if we improve our behavior as a group, we will experience less of those negative assumptions when we travel or live abroad.
You don't ever get as in, oh yeah, I'm from England, I'm British. Hooligans, you don't get that.
No, I think
that's a male
more
thing.
Like, yeah, more sort of, ha-ha, Brexit, what a bunch of idiots, or like the Queen, Harry Potter is a big one. Mm. Princess Diana, still a big figure.
Yes.
On whom I have very few opinions to the disappointment of a lot of Colombians I've met. So stigma, I'm not sure. There's definitely I would say, you know, as in any culture, there's a sexualization of the different. So being, you know, a very pale person, I stick out a lot. And, you know, catcalling is a thing.
Yeah.
But again, you know, the levels of real sexual violence that foreign women are subjected to in this country are actually not very high compared to Colombian women. So it doesn't really translate into real problems in the way that stigma against, for example, Venezuelan people or people of minority ethnicities in this country does. You know what I mean?
I'm with you on that one entirely. I don't think about it very much. Have I changed or made any changes to my everyday behavior given the relative perception of insecurity? I'll answer in Bogota, as a parent, I'm obviously very aware of what's going on around me. I think that's the key issue for me. I do see people approaching sort of car doors every now and then. It's an everyday occurrence. It's not that they're targeting. I don't believe them to be targeting me as a foreigner. I think the target who looks, you know, amenable, accessible. Aside from that, you know, it's the usual things, isn't it? It's like just being careful. I haven't really made that many changes. Yourself out there in Medellin?
I think the perception of increased security risk is very much a Bogota story.
Mm.
That story that I have been following seems very centralized to the capital.
Mm.
And a lot of those security tapes of robberies and horror stories that they're happening in Bogota. I don't know anything about the stats there. But I do think, you know, it's a very centralist country. So that story sort of feels as though it applies to the whole country, but really it's a capital city story.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know. I love it. You were talking. Was it a police car in the background that went past just then?
Alfred, that's the Aguacate man.
Oh, okay.
Who has a better sound system than any police vehicle that I have ever heard. Before him was the Masamora guy. If listeners are looking for a guided tour of the soundscape, the Hare Krishna temple who live opposite me, I'm sure will be chanting again within a short time period. So if you hear handbells, that's what that is.
Handbells, avocados, and Masamora. How do you translate Masamora? How was it, like a rice?
Yeah, rice pudding.
Rice pudding, I'd say, is the best. But yes, there you go. You've got everything in a nutshell. But you're in the centro, aren't you? You're right downtown.
I do live in pleno centro, so we are. Good. Yeah.
we used to have the Masamora paisa, sort of like tuk-tuk would go around here, and it had the music goes, Masamora paisa, and it was so annoying. And one day there was a fight between one vendor and him, like fists outside. They got so fed up with the music that so there was an actual
at least he's trying to spruce it up a bit.
Yeah, he was a nice enough guy as well. I would go and down and chat to him. And then if I didn't buy something, obviously I'd been wasting his time. So I'd buy something. But we digress. We digress. Now, let's get on
security.
No. Last one. Tigran.
Oh, yeah.
Tigran sent in this one this morning, and he's lucky he got in time. Is there a shortage of bilingual experts in Colombia? Have you had an experience? Can you share with us anecdotes and so on? My one on that one is I happen to be in the hospital, not ill myself, but I happened to be in there accompanying someone. And in the bed next door, there was a Dutchman who clearly had either dengue or malaria. And the doctor didn't know how to translate what was going on. So I, just being nosy me, just walked over and said, listen, I'll translate. And was there for about 40 minutes translating his medical symptoms and so on. And having suffered from both of those illnesses, I'm very well versed in the vocabulary as well.
It seems to me a strange dichotomy in that there are a lot of Colombians with very good English.
Yeah.
And those skills seem undervalued and sort of oddly unrecognized and poorly distributed, in that where they are really needed, they often aren't.
Mm.
And they're often underpaid, those people, you know, because being bilingual is an incredible talent and skill. And English is an awful, horrible language. And anybody who learns it well should be recompensed generously for that. But you're right. I mean, I've been, particularly during the pandemic when I was trying to fly, I've sort of become the waiting room translator because nobody has thought that, you know, that would be a good skill to have in the room. Do you know what I mean? So there's, but in terms of thematics, I mean, most of the people who work for the big NGOs here are very, very skilled bilingual speakers. And so it kind of depends where you are, but at an administrative level, I'd say, yes, there is a shortage of.
So God forbid there'd be an English speaker in an airport then, like you said, in the waiting room, you're translating.
It was at both airports, actually. It was that there wasn't an English speaker and then there wasn't a Spanish speaker. It was so just good. the kind of underestimation of that as a set of skills. I think it's just mad to me. But that was also coming from the UK where famously.
We're known for it.
Yeah, it's sort of I have to say I laughed out loud while I was reading yesterday. I was reading, this sounds ridiculous, but some old writings of Jung, and he talks about word association tests. So when you say a word to someone and they say the closely most related word, and he talks about the interruptions and interferences in that, and those being what you read into to learn about their psychology. And he says the real problem comes when people speak a word in a different language. It's not much of a problem in England. 100 years ago, we still had this perfectly deserved reputation for being poor linguists.
Well, you know, I have nothing to say on the matter as someone who studied languages, but equally, I know it well. It's quite sad, isn't it? We're still poor at it.
It's a cultural arrogance that sort of bleeds about the country. But I do wish that people who spoke two languages, you know, I'm not just talking about myself, obviously, but were better recognized. And because there are, you know, people who have that skill, who there's no really good jobs for them, despite that being an incredible talent to have.
Well, let's pick up on politics then, because that dovetails perfectly into politics and peace. And this was a good one. I mean, I think it was Julian in Germany, if I'm not mistaken. It's security. Has it really deteriorated as badly as is being reported? What do the statistics of the past years until now tell us? Do you have any thoughts on this from your base in Medellin? I mean, we see these news reports daily, and of course in your news report there's usually an update on massacres or community or social leaders being assassinated, killed or and so on. So it does seem that it's ever present, but what do we think? I've got some stats and I'll jump in a second.
I mean, from the point of view of the killings of signatories to the peace deal, of massacres, the numbers aren't massively spiking in a sustained way. You know, we're not seeing particular growth, say, in the last 2 years or so that really holds up in the stats on that. But over the last 5 years, you know, things are not getting better as they should be, given that supposedly Colombia was at war and now is not at war. The figures have not improved as they should have done, given that fact. But Richard, I'll let you jump in because I'm not actually that well versed in the stats, you know.
I was looking through and there's so much out there, and it all depends where you look. I mean, if you look in Semana and read any of their headlines, Semana magazine, you know, we're living the greatest halcyon days ever in Colombia. And then if you read I don't know, what is it, Basta Ya from the Centro de Memoria Histórica, everything is truly dreadful. And if you use Indepaz, I would say that's probably the most accurate. So we've got to kind of, you know, reach a happy medium in between it. And what we can see is, I'm summarizing immensely because I think we could write dissertations on this, is that from 2013 onward, there's been a steady decrease in sort of homicides and that level of violence. So I mean, you see that, and it's high. It's what we're looking at, 62 per 100,000 Pastrana, so that's 98 to 2002. And then it, Uribe 1 is 42, Uribe 2 is 34. So you can see it dropping. Santos, his first term, it's down to 31.9. Santos, second term, 25.18. And then in Duque's first couple of years, it's 24, so it's still dropped. But, of course, there are all sorts of things to bring in that. And you know, you've got the what's known as the peace dividend. So from really mid-2015, when people knew that the talks were ongoing and there was a unilateral ceasefire, it wasn't bilateral. And then, of course, 2016, 17, and the downs from the talks themselves. And then, we go into the Duque era, and there's the quarantine as well. And everywhere in the region, aside from Mexico, experiences quite a significant drop in violence. Well, we're all at home. But of course, you broke a story as well. Was it for the Telegraph or the Times many months ago?
It was about the Telegraph. Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah.
About, so it seems. About the violence, of course, during the quarantine. So there you go.
Right. I mean, during the quarantine, everywhere, violence, as you say, went down, but the killing of social leaders went up because their murderers knew where to find them, and the murder of women by their partners went up. Yeah. So, you know, it's as it's, as it is said, there are lies, damned lies, and statistics, and you can really, you can play them lots of different ways, as you say, you know, the media and various institutions play them and cut them and slice them in ways that are not terribly objective.
We're looking, and I said 2013 as a starting point, but if you look at Sia Vasia, it's a very good online sort of, I don't know what you'd call it. It's journalism, but there's also other investigations.
Academia.
But in 2012, there were 16,000 homicides. You know, it's in 2021, there were 13,700. It's gone down, but it's still unacceptable. I mean, let's just say it's like that. And at the same time, if we look at 2020, you know, there were 90 massacres, which led to the deaths of 381 people. 2021, 96 massacres, 338 victims. And in 2022 so far, with a cutoff of the 24th of April, 36 massacres leading to the deaths of 133 victims. So what it really is, and I think you back me up on this, it's a transformation of the violence that we're seeing. Because previously, and I've spoken to lots of people, you know, the UN and Red Cross and so on, that they were able to obviously negotiate with large groups because there's a chain of demand. Now, as reported in the New York Times, and I think quoted by Adam Isaacson from the Washington office on Latin America, there are more than 30 different armed groups within the country vying for strategic routes, drug smuggling, people trafficking, arms, you name it. And you can't negotiate with them all on the same levels. And the transformation as well, it makes, rather than sort of, you know, haphazard killings, they're very targeted. Like you say, peace accord signatories, social leaders, community leaders. And so maybe, and of course, we're in, you know, between 2012 and now, we're in immediate communication. Everything is known within seconds, you know, and so there's this transformation. And I don't know what you can say is the violence right now is not to our 2012 or through 2002 levels, but should things continue along this path, it's going to get worse. I think that's the way to put it. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I think it's, as you say, the violence has simply transformed. And we're looking at, instead of a war between people who, at least in theory, had political demands and the government could negotiate with them, there are no political demands among these new groups. The government cannot negotiate with them because to give them what they want would be against all international law and the constitution and sort of really against all sense in terms of what a government should be up to. So I would say also, again, a complicating factor with these stats is that they are collected in different ways over time. It's really difficult to compare them. Again, with homicides, you know, what looks like a conflict kill or a massacre or a homicide, you know, and certain outlets will say, you know, there was a massacre, but four of these guys were in an armed group. So it was more of a conflict situation. You know what I mean? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, killing of another human is a murder and full stop, end of sentence. But in terms of statistics, that's incredibly complicated to do comparisons over time as well.
And as you say, the terminology, what does the government use? They use it. They don't say massacres. They say selective multiple killings or something.
Something like that. Something. And, you know, Indepaz considers a massacre, I think it's anything over three or four people.
Three or four, yeah.
Whereas the international definition is actually, I think, over eight. So again, you know, terminology is complicating. I don't have any thoughts either way. Again, killing a person, killing more than a person, like we should be writing it all down somewhere, but we do need to be careful about saying it's definitely rising or it's definitely falling. Yeah. Because we don't really have that information.
I also, there's another element to this before we go on to the next question as well, is that 34% of all of these homicides, killings take place in basically three departments. So it's Antioquia, Valle, and Nariño, Cauca. I can't remember which one of the two. That's three from every 10, you know, so the concentration of that, whereas Antioquia, obviously the capital being Medellin, Medellin's homicide rate has dwindled in terms of what it used to be back in the, you know, the really dark days of the Escobar you know, era.
And it's like, it's again, it's the transformation, right? You know, it's where is power being fought over? And right now in Colombia, it's the countryside. And it's those parts of the countryside. They did the list of the most dangerous cities in the world. I think it was last month. And the three that are Colombian are all in Valle del Cauca.
Oh, really? Well, Cali.
And then... Cali, Buenaventura, and Palmira.
Palmira. Interesting. Oh, well, that's just on the outskirts, isn't it?
Right. I mean, yeah, it could be swallowed by Cali sort of within the next growth spurt. But it's definitely... You know, which maybe brings us onto
the Buenaventura question.
The Buenaventura question, because I think it is, you know, it's absolutely key to this question of where's profitable in the country, and where are people fighting over those profits? And Buenaventura is absolutely the result of that being the Pacific corridor for trafficking. That countryside being incredibly rich, you know, not just in being a corridor, but in wood. There's an enormous amount of money being made in deforestation in Buenaventura, as well as minerals.
And so of course, there's coca growing nearby as well, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. And those, you know, the ELN and various disidencias are there. Clan del Golfo is there, and then the urban groups in Buenaventura who are amigos, aliados of those groups. Are working for them in the urban context, which is a very concentrated violence. I was actually there, was it last month, month before in Buenaventura, and I spoke to a couple of internally displaced communities. I don't know whether the person who asked this knows that, or this is somebody I've already bored over coffee.
This is Donald in Canada.
Ah, well, a great coincidence. If anyone is interested in this, I've got some very depressing pictures of where particular indigenous communities have been given accommodation would be a grand word for what they've been given by the local government. I spoke to a woman who's exactly my age called Maricela, who went into labor in one of these shelters in Buenaventura where she'd recently been displaced. And she started having seizures because she was under a lot of stress, the doctor later said. But the ambulance would not come to the hostel because it was in a part of town where nobody goes at night for fear of gangs. And she had to be carried in a blanket by the indigenous guard to the border of gangland where the ambulance would consent to pick her up at 2 a.m. in full labor, having seizures. So the people who run from the Buenaventura countryside are not only being neglected, but face another massive challenge upon arriving at a place that they hope is safe. And the accommodation is, it's pretty bleak. One of the places I went was not even converted. It was just an office block. You know, there were 50 people living in what were really three offices. So it's pretty depressing stuff. And those waves keep coming. And there are also a lot of Afro-descendant communities who've been displaced for years from that countryside. And even if they get to go back to their land, that land is not what they left behind. And it's not just a matter of their properties having fallen apart, which obviously happens over time, particularly in that climate, but their land will have been deforested or mined or, you know, had the soil horribly degraded by someone growing coca on it. Even if you get your land back, even if it's very shortly after you're displaced, the loss that is sustained is massive. It's a very complex phenomenon that the government is not, it's not compensating for. And the stories of, you know, the army being very allied to groups in that area, I heard a few of them, and I'm pretty, you know, they are quite convincing.
There's also the culture is destroyed when you break up the family units and the towns and they get divided. That's the identity, and the culture goes as well. That's one of the things we don't talk about either. It's like, well, you know, that as you talk about the degradation of the soil, the land, and I found some figures for this as well. In 2021, there were about 17,500 people displaced in the immediate area of Buenaventura. That is 125% increase on 2020. So 2020, as you said, you're still, I guess we're looking at the isolation and the quarantine and people being a bit more careful. And then you got 2021. So like you're saying with statistics, to be able to even take a little bit of and put it into context, is that 2020 is going to be an anomaly on all of these things. You have to sort of take it in context of 2019. And so very, very disturbing what's going on. And I don't really think there's anything being done apart from, you know, the occasional, was it Diego Molano, the occasional sort of statement that they're militarizing again another section, but they don't go into, like where you said, this area. They go on the edge.
They're on the edge, and they are, you know, the people that I spoke to said that they are checked at every possible juncture by members of the Colombian military. And yet members of certain armed groups show up in their communities. You know, whose movement is really being controlled? Because it seems to a lot of the people who are being displaced that it's a lot of these structures that seem to be to fight armed groups are much more aimed at controlling the community. I don't know if you can hear that dog. Apologies.
I can hear dogs. Did you hear my child crying?
I heard the child. I mean, life continues even while podcasting. I don't know if that's a revelation to anybody. It's an interesting one. And I think the movement south of the conflict, you know, the conflict areas are expanding and moving south, which is why we're getting these waves of displacement. But I think it's important to stress that even if it's a temporary displacement, a lot of the losses are very much not temporary.
No.
It's, you know.
Now, we've got our first presidential election question, and it would just take too long to answer. But depending on who wins the presidential race, what will the next 2 to 3 years in Colombia look like? Well, my response is that if Gustavo Petro wins, that he would govern very much in a similar vein to López Obrador in Mexico, in that a lot of the time his hands would be tied and a lot of the time he'd be bitter that he wasn't able to do some of the you know, let's say, reforms that he'd like to do. And then a lot of the time, as mentioned a few podcasts ago with Sergio Guzman of Colombia Risk Analysis, he'll be up on his balcony, you know, calling the hordes to the streets and making appeals to the International Court of Inter-American Court of Human Rights and so on. That's what I feel. Whereas on the other side, if Federico Gutierrez, known as Fico, wins, I would suspect there will be a greater move to militarize problem areas such as like in Arauca. I think he backed the peace accord. At least he seems to say he did at some point, but you never really quite know. I did watch an interview with him the other day when he was talking to the CEO of ASEA, and he said, you know, 14 billion pesos are tied up in regalias, which is the sort of funds that are generated and given out to each department or state. And he was talking about this, and he was talking about how they have to get that into infrastructure. And the editor of the CEO of ASEA said, well, actually, it has nothing to do with the presidency and central government. It has regional government. And his response was, como así? That's what worried me the most, because it was unknowing of quite a serious issue. And then at the end, he talked about plata being plata. Plata es plata. And again, I know that's going to appeal to his core base. You know, money's money. But it also, it was of concern to me. So I've got concerns on both sides. How it pans out over 2 to 3 years? It'll be a stress test for Colombia on both sides. What do you say?
Yeah, I certainly think FICO is more of the same at best. The speech that he made when he won the presidential primary was a kind of A-level politics cliche of right-wing discourse. Mm-hmm. It was liberty and security, which is, you know, spine-chilling if you know what that means in practice, particularly in a country like Colombia. Whereas, you know, as you say, with Petro, you run the risk of a leftist populist who is really hostile to the press and hostile to democracy. There have been some not great interactions with the press by Petro. Mm. However, there is Francia. I mean, I do think that the cultural change, something less visible, something more nebulous that could be achieved by having someone who is truly regionalist and pro-human rights and pro the environment, even proximate to power, could be a very positive thing in the long term, even if it doesn't necessarily translate into legislation. As you say, Congress is not in Petro's favor in terms of having a majority, and he may find that very frustrating. And that may result in all kinds of discourse, like this man isn't delivering what he promised, or, you know, the right is blocking all the things we wanted to do. The potential in this country to weave a yarn, however tenuous, from an event in various directions, continues to surprise me on a weekly basis. But certainly what worries me is the environmental element. The deforestation in Colombia is wild. The leaning towards fracking is pretty concerning. Yeah, I mean, I think this ties into the next question, really. I don't want to
let's
over it.
This was from Nicholas in the UK. It's, Colombians want change, but it's unclear what type of change they want. More state, less state, more protection and subsidies, or more liberalism and free market? And if the Petro coalition wins the elections, what type of change will they bring? And how long before the country gets plunged into another political crisis? I don't know if we're emerging from a political crisis just yet. Nobody has any guesses about where I stand somewhat politically here, but I would say that we're in a crisis of independence of the institutions. This government has tied up all of the institutions with their, you know, filling the judiciary, the procuraduría, the everything else with their friends. Duque talking that he would like to be a constitutional judge in the future. That's not all too positive. Do you have any thoughts? More state, less state?
Yeah, I think in terms of what Colombians want, I think what we do see well, I mean, I don't think anybody needed to see these election results to think this, but polarization is a state of affairs, to say the least. So what Colombians want is not a single thing. Different Colombians want very different things. Some people do want liberty and security, which is, you know, I think that kind of liberty that does not come within the discourse of human rights usually does mean free marketeering. And, you know, a neoliberal approach to both the state, which would be sort of minimal state with security apparatus in full force. In terms of the international community, what is being called for over and over and over at every massacre, at every new report, is more state, but not the guys in the camo. Let's do some schools. Let's have some options so that when people, you know, armed groups look to recruit, that's more difficult for them. And I do think as well, in terms of the country being plunged into a political crisis. Well, I mean, there have been 30, it's actually 37 as of the last 24 hours, 37 massacres, and it's not May yet. So I don't know what another political crisis is, but if this isn't one, I'm not really sure what one might look like.
Could it be a bifurcation in the political crises? I mean, just sort of, I don't know.
Yeah, or sort of add a new one into the mixing bowl, I guess. I mean, I certainly think if what could cause a political crisis is the USA and international markets being left phobic and sort of doing mad things that radically affect the Colombian economy simply on the grounds that there is a leftist president in power. I think there is a danger of that. And the way the markets responded to Petro's winning the presidential primary was an indicator of that. That was pretty worrying. He had to go to a notary and sign a piece of paper saying he wasn't going to expropriate anything, which he had never said he was going to do. You know, he's not Darlin. He's never said that that's a viable policy. You know, that there's a lot of fear-mongering wandering around that actually does have, it has reflections in the international response, which affects Colombia again. And this, you know, this thing about more state, less state, when an enormous amount of Colombia's annual budget comes from the USA in terms of aid, and that aid is strictly prescribed in terms of what it's for, and it's for anti-narcotics, and they've got an idea of what that means, and that means men in camo. You know, it's more complex than just what Colombians want and what Colombian politicians do.
The left phobic thing that you said, I think that's, If let's say President Biden or whomever else creates a policy, or his hawks create a sort of policy, left phobic policy, is it? Do we think it's likely to push Gustavo Petro to become more extreme in his, let's say, okay, they've rather than trying to smooth things out, and he's not really someone who negotiates. He's not really someone who likes that very much. And that's what the big concern, of course, is, you know, Congress will be fractured, and it'll be fractured in opposition to him, I reckon, because he's not very good at doing deals. You know, he stands up, this is the way it should be. You know, I'm right.
I mean, given one hopes that it's no longer the 60s, and by turning away from Biden he won't necessarily have to run into the arms of Xi Jinping or Putin. God, one hopes. But you know, Biden came out this week and said Colombia is one of the global allies of the USA, one of the global non-NATO allies. And Duque's done a lot of, you know, work at, you know, doing his little tantrum against Russia at the UN. And, you know, all of that is about getting closer to the US. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that Biden is going to be punitive against a country that elects Petro. But we don't know who's coming next.
Yeah.
And if it goes Republican again, that relationship could be problematized.
Yeah, definitely. I think, as you say, could we find a government somewhere in there that makes it harder to recruit youngsters into groups, perhaps not by, you know, again, as you say, camouflage state, schools, law courts, you know, the rule of law, schools, hospitals, drinking water, basic human rights.
Yeah. And rights for women.
Rights for women. Again, we could go on for hours on that one. We've done the heavy stuff now. We've done the heavy lifting. Travel and tourism. This came from Simon, who's in the Midlands and who's actually coming to Colombia this summer. Mm. He says, if you could make one change to the way the Colombian tourism industry is managed or marketed, what would it be? Caveat here as well. He works in sort of like an executive tourism degree course in a university in Birmingham. So that's where it comes in. Do you have any thoughts? And I will steer you towards something that I'd like to talk about, and it's the Colombia country branding and campaigns.
I mean, Richard, you own various tourism-based industries, and I would feel mildly idiotic answering the question at all, given that you're here and given that it's being asked by someone who studies tourism. So aside from saying, let's do it in an environmentally friendly manner, I'm going to just shut up.
Okay. Well, it's good you said that, because one of the big bees in my bonnet is this move to try and make everything sustainable, at least on paper. And it's not. I mean, the whole... there must be a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of actual operators, agencies, hotels, etc., that are ecologically, environmentally sustainable businesses. But the infrastructure is very limited here for us to be so. As you say, I have a couple of businesses in it. And you know, the town of Mompox, where I have my businesses, was a couple of years ago was declared a sustainable tourism destination. And to date, I don't know what that means, because if you wanted to say that it was sustainable and that it attracts tourists all year round, well, that's not true. Because we have, like everywhere in Colombia, huge damaging, economically very beneficial high seasons, but very damaging to the economy in terms of trying to work it out and spread it out over the year. And we have low seasons where there is not, you know, nary a Colombian or foreigner in the town. So if you're talking from that level, it's not sustainable. If you're talking from the environmental level, you know, we're still dumping stuff in the river. There's no proper waste collection in the town. People don't have drinking water. Yeah, so we're not. And this obviously is replicated, I don't know, 100,000 times across the country. I wouldn't even want to hazard a figure. So my feeling is that each new cabinet tourism body comes in and you know, they have the right ideas and the benefit. They want to make good on it, but they have to show figures and numbers back to central government. And they have to show a degree of progress. And so to do so, again, we come back to terminology without actual substance. And that's my issue. And then the final thing I'd like to say is these country branding campaigns. I think we should probably stick with one for a while. You know, let's really get it out there and the recognition rather than every couple of years, because there have been some real flops. I think the Sabrosura, which can't be really translated into English. So Colombia is tastiness. I don't know. Colombia is, I don't know, vibrant. I don't know what you want to say. And then there was Colombia's rhythm. Okay. Colombia's passion was probably the best at the very beginning. I don't know. The only risk is wanting to stay came at a time where you could play off the sort of drop in kidnappings to foreigners wanting to stay type thing. But I don't even know what the one is now, but I just wish they'd stop flip-flopping on this one. Maybe take one item and get us all behind it. That's my feeling on it. And I know it's hard, but we kind of have to accept also the reality of what goes on in Colombia and not deny it. And say, oh, you know, we have the best restaurants, or we have the best restaurant in top 10 in Bogota in South America. Great. But there's so much more, you know. So I think there's this focus on top 10s and lists. It's kind of ends up being like a BuzzFeed ministry. I don't know. Have I made sense, Emily?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the lack of staying power, the lack of commitment to a narrative. But equally, I'm sort of glad they moved on from all of those reasonably quickly. There's something sort of uncomfortably orientalizing about, you know, claiming that a Latin American country is necessarily passion or rhythm. That to me feels like very orientalist and reductive. And, you know, certainly the type of tourism that comes to Medellin is a sort of fetishistic, orientalizing white gaze that thinks that Colombian women are inherently more beautiful or more passionate, or, you know what I mean? Like there's a kind of hedonistic orientalism that comes with the use of ideas of like sabrosura, something that doesn't, a type of tourism that doesn't necessarily come to learn and respect and enjoy, but comes to sort of like let loose some wildness that is attached to a non-white country. I don't know, the politics of all of that to me feel very uncomfortable.
As you say, exactly, the fetishism of it, there is. And of course, and I can say, you know, the passion on the other side, you could, that passion, of course, will be interpreted that way in somewhere like Medellin. But if you come, if we take it from my perspective in Mompox, we get a very well-traveled sort of clientele coming through, looking for architecture and looking for authenticity, and the passion comes through that, or the sabrosura comes through that. But of course, the flip side is, of course, Medellin and Cartagena, of course, is another flip side type place. So it's hard. Donald again asks, how was Semana Santa in Mompox this year? Well, it was full. It was full of Colombians. And we had a great season, thankfully. it's very nice to see an upturn in businesses after 14 months of total misery. But okay, let's get on to the miscellaneous, because I know we've got to end this soon. And these are quite fast. Miscellaneous questions. Why do carrier bags always get tied in a knot which cuts off your finger's circulation? So that's a reference to carrier bags in supermarkets. I can't answer it. I just can't.
Something about the physics of thin handles and heavy objects causing rotation would be my guess. My solution, because I am the soy latte sipping hipster asshole that I've been accused of being online, is to use sustainable carrier bags, because you won't have that problem with them.
We do that too as well. We have canvas bags we use for those.
Exactly. Perfect.
But I do recall them cutting off the circulation on my fingers back in the day. I don't know what it is. I think they tie it up so you can't slip anything else in there. I think that's it at the end.
Interesting.
That's my feeling. Why doesn't Colombia have a more interesting cheese industry, given that they have so much dairy? Now, given that cheese is a food group, I feel strongly about this. The best cheese for my money is Piper cheese out of Boyaca. It's actually got flavor. It's a bit aged because there's this insistent on what's known as fresh cheese. Now, are you vegan?
I'm not. No, okay. Absolutely not.
Okay. So what do you think about this? Because there is, you know, there is a dearth of cheese.
There is I have to say, it's one of my few gripes with Colombia. I actually, this isn't just a European gripe. I have a Venezuelan friend here in Medellin who is furious about the lack of cheese here, because in Venezuela, you know, massive economic collapse, there was an amazing range of cheeses. This is not a problem with the region, with the climate. This is a cultural question. And it may be that Venezuela has more of a Europhilic history and maybe more of a desire to emulate those culinary cultures. Equally, my friend, who is a real foodie, is furious about the pastries here and the butter. Like it's a more generalized thing, I think. So I think maybe the answer is just that no one wants it.
Only
foreigners looking for a brie, you know. Colombians, they've got queso, quesito, queso costeño.
I come back from overseas always, and if anyone comes back, it's I ask for cheddar. And last night, can I just say that my youngest son opened the fridge, took out the last lump of cheddar, ate half of it, and gave the other half to the dog. I'm a bit upset. I'm a bit upset. I kind of lost my temper with everybody in the house. So, but, And then, and we've got the final question. What kind of cheese is it that folks in Bogota put into their hot chocolate? Now, I don't put cheese into my hot chocolate. I have had the cheese in the hot chocolate as an experience. It is the closest translation is it could be mascarpone. It's the most similar. It's a firm but creamy cheese that melts easily.
Because in Antioquia, they'll just drop a a queso costeño in there.
Oh, really? And make it salty.
I've had a couple of different types of cheese floating in my hot chocolate in the hills around Antioquia. I never complained, to be honest, because if it's made with water, it definitely adds something.
Yeah, because there's a bit there.
It definitely was a surprise the first time I had a hot chocolate here. Nobody warned me, and it arrived, and it had a cube of cheese floating in it. But, you know, you can adapt to anything, right?
Yeah. Have you had one of those salpicons, like the fruit salads, and then they shave cheese on top?
Oh, I had something in Valle del Cauca, actually, last year. I can't even remember what it was called, but it had sliced fruit.
Yeah.
And cherry syrup.
Yeah.
And then milk. And then grated parmesan.
Condensed milk.
It was the single most bizarre thing in a cup anyone has ever...
Is that a cholao?
It was a cholao. That's what it's called. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I was so excited because my Vayuna friends were like, this is what we eat here. You're going to love it. This is the specialty. I was like, this is four different specialties in one cup. What's that? Yeah, it was the parmesan that really threw me off. I'll be honest. The rest of it,
Parmesan styled.
You're right. I don't want to be sued by any Italians.
Quick digression. I spent many years ago as a young buck. I was in Ukraine when I was 18, 1995, and they used to put in my family. I couldn't speak for any other family there. Garlic in the coffee.
Wow.
And that's just not something I could come to terms with. And it was, I think the word for garlic was chisnook, and it was like, Richard, chisnook. And we were about to drop it in my coffee. I'm like, no. But I don't mind the cheese in the garlic. I find it, you know, it's kind of endearing, I think.
It's specific.
Yeah.
That's the best word I can come up with right now. But it's not bad. It's not good. It's just something to get used to.
I get the feeling that it's like a lot of these sort of very traditional platters. It's meant to fill you up before you go out and work the fields.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, as English people, we can't really be running around criticizing other people's food. Because unless you're really into like pie or deep fried stuff, we owe our entire culinary and cuisine goodness to immigrant communities, to whom this we ought true. To be incredibly grateful that we're not still eating turnips and mash. Those in glass houses throwing stones. I don't know what the exact expression is, but you know what I mean. I'm not going to be throwing any.
Living glass houses don't throw stones. But also, you know, I mean, I guess our main cuisine now is curry, isn't it? Isn't it curry? I love a curry.
Which is fantastic. But again, you know,
it's not us.
A grand gift of a fantastic immigrant community. I don't think we even had spices before some very bad bits of English history. But it was not, you know, not something to be proud of.
No, we can't really. Well, let's bring it to an end. Can I say thank you, Emily? And
thanks for having me.
No, it's been good. It's been great. In fact, it's always fun, isn't it? So, and thank you to Nicholas, Julian, Susan, Sarah Louise, Simon, Emma Louise, Donald, and Tigran, who sent in the questions.
Thank you very much.
Priority was given, of course, to our Patreon supporters. So therefore, sign up for Patreon.
Thanks, guys.
patreon.com/Columbia Calling. You'll get the newscast there as well. And of course you get, I'm trying to work out more special things to give you. We're working it out. It's a process. But this has been episode 421 with myself and Emily Hart there in Medellin. Thank you everyone for listening. I know you've enjoyed this one just as you did episode 407 in January. That's us signing off for today.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
La canoa de Bareque para llegar.